From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. I'm Nate Russell. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Digital Podcast. Glad that you are with us. Dan Erickson is our guest today. Dan is a friend and a colleague and somebody who's been around UCB and our digital filmmaking community for a few years now. And actually, Dan heard that we were doing our book club and said, hey, I just made an independent film for the first time. Why don't I come on the show and let's talk about the lessons from the book as it applied to someone actually making a film? And I said, that sounds like a great episode. So Sophie, our calls for emails on episode ideas worked out this time.
Yeah, it really did.
for the first time ever. And look, we did it. We got an email and we said, yeah, that sounds like a great episode and we're doing it. So really excited for that. How are you doing, Sophie? Your summer is rapidly coming to an end here.
It is, and I feel like I just got into summer mode.
I know. But, you know, the good news is that it's going to be warm here in New York for at least another month, right?
Oh, yeah.
September is like the nicest month in New York, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, September is so beautiful.
It's going to be great. Yeah. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited for this conversation. I mean, you know, you were here when we did this
yeah.
interview. It's really fun to
pop in there. Yeah.
It's fun to talk to somebody about, you know, we just all finished the book. Dan just finished the book too. He hadn't read the book to come in and sit down with us, but it was exciting to sort of like be able to sort of like take some of the hypothetical from last week's episode and talk about how it actually applied in a real filmmaking setting.
Yeah, that was really nice hearing about his real world experience versus what the book. And I mean, and there were certain things he was like, oh, I wish I had known that.
Yeah. Yeah. So very, very exciting. I want to give out one plug here. Former guest of ours, Zach Broussard, has a Kickstarter going right now. Have you seen this, Sophie? The New York Sorta Marathon?
Yes. Someone just told me about this last night.
It's up. It's up. It's on Kickstarter.
Fine.
You should go support it. So if you ever thought that marathons were too long, guess what? Zach's throwing a marathon that takes the 26.2 and turns it into just 0.2. which is great. Anyone can finish
idea.
It. Anyone can finish it. You'll get pictures. You'll get everything you need to brag online about it. And there's some great rewards if you back the project right now. So another epic prank from Zach Broussard coming to New York sometime this fall.
Because let's be honest, if you're running a marathon, you're bragging about it on social media. That's all you're doing it for.
That's true. Absolutely. So check that out. We'll tweet out a link to that Kickstarter event, which I think you have a few more days to get on if you're getting this episode when it's fresh off the presses. And check it out. Follow us at UCB Digital and UCB Digital Podcasts on Twitter and Facebook. All right, let's dig into today's episode, our case study. So as we were saying before, we all just finished as part of our Maker Book Club, The Real Truth by Reed Martin. Reed actually reached out to say thanks this week. That was another fun thing that happened. And thank you to Reed for listening to the show.
Thank you, Reed.
And he's going to have some feedback for us, Sophie, soon here. So we'll be able to share with our listeners his feedback on our feedback.
Yeah.
It'll be an endless feedback loop.
and then we'll have some feedback back to him.
Yeah, that's right.
And he'll feedback
back and forth
to us.
Forever. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's all that this podcast will be from now on. But we did our book club. We all read the book, and we wanted to sit down. Dan made the suggestion. We said, yeah, hell yeah, let's do it. So talk to Dan about his movie, which is called A Sibling Mystery. It's a movie that he co-wrote and co-directed with his writing and directing partner, Rachel Wartell. And I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm sorry if I'm not, Rachel. But Dan and Rachel made this film. We go into the process of making it. We apply the lessons from Reed's book from start to finish and sort of say, where did some of these textbook, process, you know, suggestions and lessons line up with the nitty-gritty reality of trying to get a feature film made in 2017. Dan, of course, also a friend. He was on UCB One for a long time. He was like one of the main editors on that team, has been an editor for a long time on the show Blue Bloods here in New York, which I know, Sophie, you're a big fan of.
Love Blue Bloods.
Huge Blue Bloods fan. Yeah.
Me and every mom.
Can't get enough of that. I mean, Tom Selleck, right?
Hello.
Tom Selleck. Can't get enough of it. So a longtime editor on that show as well, and is now stepping into the writing and directing chair of his first feature, which has been on the festival run. So excited to sort of take the opportunity to talk to a filmmaker about where the textbook lessons apply and don't in real life. So let's jump into it. Our conversation with Dan Erickson. So Dan, the movie's called A Sibling Mystery. I saw you just had another screening last week.
Yeah, we did at the Kew Gardens Film Festival.
How does it feel to see a feature film of yours on the big screen? What's the feeling like? Are you still nervous when you watch it in big crowds,
yeah,
or is it like, what's the feeling now?
It's nerve-wracking, but it's sort of the good kind of nerve-wracking, because especially, you know, like compared to like something like improv, I get really nervous, but yeah. For that, you know, you're nervous to see how people are going to react and maybe a little bit nervous about the Q&A. But, you know, it's passive. You don't have to do anything. You just sort of get to, and it's also really fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's really gratifying to hear people laugh.
Yeah.
And react.
Yeah. I remember, like, doing, you know, doing South by Southwest, like, as a premiere. I remember being, like, way more interested in watching the people. I would sit in the back so that you could sort of, so it wasn't awkward that you were turning around.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you'd sit in the back of the theater and just like, wouldn't even look at the screen, just looking at people like, is this next joke going to hit?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah. Is this next joke going to hit? No, fuck, it didn't, right? Like,
yeah,
that kind of feeling.
And sort of notice, it's interesting to notice the patterns of what people do react to. Like, there's some lines in the movie that like, while I was editing it, while we were making it, I never knew were going to be laugh lines, but they are consistently laugh lines in audiences. And there's some things that I find really funny that I expect people to laugh at that, you know, it's just, they don't.
Something changes in that group setting on a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
You're never watching it that way. You're watching it on a normal size screen.
Yeah.
In a room with one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that aspect of like, there's something about that big, like the size of the screen, the volume of the sound, and the fact that you're in a communal experience with other people that does change some of what will hit.
Yeah.
In a way that is like hard to, it's hard to anticipate. Even if you've done it, you know what I mean? It's hard to anticipate because it's, I don't know, it takes on an energy. Each screening takes on the energy of its, you know, its own energy.
Yeah.
Which is really fun.
Yeah, it's really fun.
That's why I feel like movies aren't going to die, because like that energy is like a living, breathing experience that like, so long as humans are living and breathing, we're going to want to, you know what I mean? Experience.
I agree. And I hope you're right. It would be so sad if we eventually just didn't have theatrical movies.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
It really would. So, you know, we were sort of talking about this as a case study into the sort of like tips and tricks and all the 500 pages of Reed Martin's The Real Truth,
mm-hmm.
Which you've been reading along as well.
Yeah.
Very nice of you to do that.
I enjoyed it.
So I guess like maybe let's just start here for folks who don't know the movie. Give me what's the pitch of the movie that we're talking about, and how did it come about?
So it's called A Sibling Mystery, and it's a mystery comedy about a brother and sister who are staying in their aunt's Chinatown apartment, and they see a mysterious woman in the window, and they're trying to figure out who she is because they're getting ready for a party at the end of the summer, and they don't want this mysterious woman to ruin their party plans.
Yeah. And when and how long ago did you start making it, and when did you finish?
It's been 2 years, which is crazy.
Really?
Yeah. We wrote it in the fall, the spring of 2015,
okay.
And then we shot it in the summer of 2015, edited for about a year, and then, you know, did final post, sound mixing, score, color correction, all that, and submitted to festivals, and we've been taking it on the festival circuit for so far since March.
Okay.
Yeah.
And at this point, so now it's played in, I'm seeing on your website, four festivals.
Mm-hmm.
And from here, what's next for it? Can people see it soon? Are you going to sort of go like a, you know, like any sort of like VOD route? Like what's the next, what's the next steps for it?
Yeah, well, we're still going to figure that out. We're still going to festivals.
Mm-hmm.
We have two coming up, but unfortunately I can't publicly announce either of them.
Sure.
And we have more that we're waiting to hear back from. But yeah, eventually we want to get it online. You know, as one of the things that this book talks about is how difficult it is to get, you know, a distribution deal. But there are ways to get it on like Amazon Prime, for example, like pretty easily. There's this thing called Distribber that we're considering using, but we're also hoping, you know, maybe we could get some sort of a distribution company, because that's a huge ecosystem now, like sort of smaller online venues, and we've been approached by some that we're considering, but Yeah, so eventually it'll be online.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this was a first. This was a first feature.
Yeah.
For you
mm-hmm.
and your co-director as
yes.
well. First yeah. feature for everybody.
Right. Yes. And all yeah, right. I should mention at any time I say I probably really mean we, me and Rachel, my dear friend, who we wrote it and directed it together and produced it together.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it definitely has a like. I'm definitely curious about some of the production components because it feels like. It definitely feels like you like, and knowing you, like this was something that was like a passion project and something that feels like, I'm like, oh, I think they probably stole some shots here.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm curious to sort of like dig yeah. into that with you. But if we use this real truth as sort of like a blueprint case study and like the reality of making a feature film and knowing that you're still sort of like mid progress on the back end of it,
mm-hmm.
You know, he sort of starts off in this book talking about the mindset of beginning a project, mm-hmm. proposals, business plans,
yes,
starting an LLC for the film itself,
mm-hmm.
thinking about it as in the sort of terms of a startup. Now,
yeah.
for you, is that how you did approach this film, or what was the path as it was starting? You write a script, that's creative passion. The actual mm-hmm. sort of like, we're going to make this thing and try to take it somewhere and have a goal set for it. What was that thought process for you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would say compared to sort of the things that he's talking about, especially earlier in the book, this was more of sort of a DIY approach, which I thought was one of the interesting things because this was written, I think, in 2009, right?
Yeah, yeah. The world has evolved.
The world has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting to sort of get a snapshot of what things were like in 2009. Some things, you know, you could see are pretty similar to today, but I think a lot has changed, and one of the things I think is sort of the career model of not necessarily making a, you know, right out of the gate a huge feature that sells and then you're on the map, but building a career sort of in a DIY way, starting small for a first
sure.
film and then going from there. But and he also talks about a lot about the sort of like legal aspects of you know, starting an LLC and business plans and, you know, creating a legal entity and all that stuff. But we wrote it ourselves, so we didn't have to worry about any of the intellectual property
sure.
concerns that he goes into, although it was good to know. We did start an LLC, didn't have to worry because we were, you know, producing it ourselves. We didn't have to enter into any like sort of scary partnerships.
Sure.
Legally.
Were you seeking financing, or where did money
financing
come from? Because that's part of what he's describing too, is you're setting yourself up with some of these things like a proposal and a business plan and a sort of chain of title on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On any sort of like materials, because you have an eye towards like, if someone's going to finance this, I need to be able to get the financing and protect myself against all eventualities once I secure
right.
it. So yeah, financing wise, what was that process
yeah,
for you
guys? We self-financed it. So we didn't have to worry about that either. But yeah, one of the things that I thought was really valuable about this book was sort of getting a glimpse into like, you know, for a future thing, because I want to, you know, do bigger and better in the future, and sort of getting an idea of what sort of pitfalls there are and what that entails.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like in the future, I'd like to do something where I can get some financing to make a next movie. But for this one, we didn't have to worry about it. We, you know, we had some savings and we put that towards the project.
So pretty nominal, I'm assuming. You know what I mean? He's talking about, he's talking in here to like Doug Liman, who's saying he shot Swingers for $200K.
Yeah.
We're not talking 200. You don't have to tell me
oh,
the number.
No,
but
no.
We're not talking
oh,
200K,
my Lord, no.
right?
No.
We're talking about like some bootstraps and some favors and sort
yeah.
of like scrapping it together and probably stealing some locations too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I, definitely that is something that has gotten, I don't want to say easier because it's not easy, but it's become more accessible. I feel like this book a lot says, it has the mindset of like, you need to be doing something that is good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's the financiers or the distributor or the marketer or the mass audience that you're trying to like find, or the industry to get yourself noticed.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, did you listen to that Mark Duplass thing that was like his keynote from a few years ago?
Yeah, I love that.
The cavalry thing. Mm-hmm. If anybody out there hasn't heard that, it's
great.
Great.
Yeah.
But like that mindset is the other direction, which is, no, we're going to do us and we're going to invest in each other. And the tools are accessible enough now that we can do our voice and do our thing and amplify it to a scale that's like big enough that essentially this whole thing is we're the cavalry.
Yeah.
Right.
I find that very inspiring. And that's sort of the approach that we took, you know, starting small, using the resources we had at our disposal, you know, with the hopes of getting it out there, meeting people, having something to show for it, and, you know, sort of building in a gradual way towards bigger projects.
So you're sort of setting yourself up. You've got the LLC,
mm-hmm.
which is just for the film, right? It's not like you were starting a production company.
Yeah. Although I think, We still have it, so we might use it for future things. Yeah.
Okay. So you have the LLC. You don't need to worry about the financing. How about like any sort of like legal consultation? He's highly recommending independent filmmakers with legal consultation.
You know, we didn't.
No.
That's, you know, maybe that's something that we could have benefited from, but so far it hasn't. We haven't run into any issues, and also, you know, as a result of my job and prior experience, I sort of knew certain aspects of the legal realm that we had to avoid. Like, you know, a big thing is avoiding any copyrighted material. And I was super anal about that. Like, we had no artwork on the walls, nothing visible that was, that we couldn't, that, you know, basically that wasn't by our friends and we had permission.
So you did take that mindset even in sort of like, going into an apartment and using the artwork. You were cognizant of those surroundings.
Yeah. Because that's one that, I mean, that's one that you can run into trouble with.
Yeah. I noticed you used a, I say FUDs, maybe they say foods.
Oh, yeah.
But I noticed the FUDs menu that you stuck to the wall at one point, which anybody doesn't know is a joke menu. You didn't hear about that, Sophie?
What is that?
Yeah, they turned into a book. It was Arthur Meyer and Dan Klein and Kelly Hudson, and they wrote this fake menu, and I believe it was on Arthur's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
They distributed it all over town.
Yeah, we walked from the north end of Manhattan to the south end, handing them out.
And it caught on as sort of like this weird, you know, semi-viral sort of like sensation. They got a book deal out of it.
Yeah.
Ah.
And I think some famous chef wrote, Mario Batali,
yeah, that sounds right.
Wrote the intro to the book or something because it's like, it's just this weird foodie thing.
Oh,
it's hilarious.
Fun. That's cool. Yeah.
But even that is like, that was a nice little wink towards like, you needed a menu. You used one that was like, totally clear because it's like your friends.
Yeah.
And you can sort of, you can get away with it.
Yeah, we were really careful about that. Just because, you know, because we were putting so much effort into it and I wanted to make sure we didn't hit some point down the line where we could get an opportunity, but we were held back because of some stupid thing, like using something unclear, whatever.
What about music?
We were also careful about that. We most of the music is the score, which is all original. We hired a composer, which was one of the most awesome parts of this whole process. Actually, it worked out really well. So that's all, you know, we have the rights to it, and then the rest of it, like there's some like source music, like sort of like pop music playing, and that our friend wrote and recorded for us.
Oh yeah, there's just like a scene in the car where she's singing to herself. So why did it work out so well to use a composer? Was it just fun?
Well,
you go to the studio, you sort of see it happen. It's really fun. Yeah, it's super fun.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we didn't get to go because it was actually recorded in Oakland, California. the whole process happened across the country. So the story is we were going to have our friend, who's a really good musician, help us with the score. And I'm also sort of a musician, so I was going to do it along with him. And it was just going to be sort of like another DIY aspect of the movie. But he was too busy, and so we were trying to figure out a plan B for the score. And we were using some of this guy's music. He's a jazz musician named Ben Goldberg. And, you know, he has a website, and I figured, hey, why not, like, email this guy, tell him that we're filmmakers. We're looking for a score. We're looking for like sort of like a jazz mystery type score, and we like his music. So I emailed him thinking maybe like, you know, maybe he'll know a student of his or something that he could recommend who could work for, you know, a smaller amount of money. But he emailed back and he was like, oh, this sounds cool. We should talk on the phone. I might be able to get into the studio on Tuesday if that works for you. And I was like, oh my, you know, dude, like, yeah. Wow, that was quick. That worked out well. And then, you know, in retrospect, now I realize, you know, I think as musicians want to work, and this was just a gig and they were jazz musicians. Yeah. So it's pretty easy to, not easy, but you know, it's not terribly labor intensive to write original stuff, because they could just sort of have like the idea of it and then I think, you know, improvise.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. That's definitely true, right? But it's a hard thing to sort of like remember is that like, yeah, musicians want to work.
Yeah.
Shit, actors want to work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the other thing. It's like maybe not necessarily like on a project that can't pay them or that's like super inconvenient, but it's like, if you have a project that like, you know what I mean? If you have some money or if you have something that's like super cool, asking can't hurt, because like people want creative outlets. And if you're viable, I mean, who's going to say no to it? Isn't that why we all do this? It's to like do fun, cool things.
Yeah. And yeah, that was one of the definite lessons of this movie, is like, you know, like if you ask people for something or if you approach people, I think more often than not, people will assume that it's legit more so than you might expect if it's your first project. Like, I don't think this guy doubted that this was a real movie. I mean, we sort of knew that it was our first thing. Mm-hmm. We weren't sure if it was going to end up being a real thing, although I think the final product is. But yeah, it was cool to realize like, yeah, you can get out there and approach people and they'll take you seriously.
In going into production, what size crew did you carry? Mm-hmm. How many days did you shoot this feature in?
So we kept the crew very small. For the most part, it was DP plus me and Rachel. Uh-huh. I was also on camera for a lot of it. Sound person, and we usually had a friend or two around to sort of be an all-purpose PA, helper, producer, you know. So honestly, it was mostly that complete skeleton crew.
So like five or six.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's tiny.
Mm-hmm.
That's very tiny.
Yeah. Like,
but also means that you're mobile. It means that you can steal shots because you're not going to cause too much of a stink. You're not going to have a lot of control, but you're not going to cause too much of a stink.
And yeah, it allowed us to shoot on the street with no permits and no, you know, crew locking down the street or anything like that, you know. And when you keep it really small like we did, we were also shooting with the Blackmagic pocket camera, which is tiny.
Yeah.
People don't even think that you're doing it. You know, they just walk by. So, you know, people don't.
Yeah, they're great background.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they're just living their lives. They don't even notice. Yeah, it's great. Especially if you can't see their faces, you're like, mwah, you know. That's great, man. How many days?
The main production phase we shot, I think it was 22 days.
Hmm.
And then we went back and shot a couple things. We were planning to shoot the last scene in a movie theater because the main actress, Lily Meyer, her parents owned a movie theater, but they sold it, so we didn't get to shoot the last scene in a movie theater, so we shot it in a hotel. But we had saved that, so we shot that like maybe 4 months after we shot the rest of it, actually.
And was there anything that you needed to go back to and do any pickup days, or was it reshoots or anything like that, or was it just the 22 days of principal?
It was just that. I did one pickup shot of the laundromat sign to establish that it was a laundromat, because in actuality it was just a stairway down to the basement kitchen of a restaurant.
Right.
But I think the sign really sells it.
from that sound then, knowing a little bit about what that production is structured like, it sounds like probably your primary expense here was food.
Yeah.
To feed people for 22 days is comparative to what any of those other costs might be, feels like it's probably the more significant.
Yeah. And we were paying the DP. Uh-huh. And we were paying the sound people. So yeah, it was basically those, you know, paying those people and the food, and then post production cost a little bit of money, but that, you know, we had a year to keep on working our day jobs and, you know,
working on it after. Yeah. Yeah. And you did all, you cut too.
Yeah.
Because that's your day job is cutting. So you're going, you're cutting all day, going home, cutting all night.
Yeah. So that.
Living that dream.
Yeah. I don't know. I've wondered about that. Like if you weren't an editor and you had to hire an editor, like, because editing just takes a long time and it's very time consuming.
Yeah.
I wonder what it would cost to do a movie like that, but hire an editor.
Now, and you were also, so how much did any of this cross over with the stuff you were doing? I'm now asking for me. Did any of this cross over with the stuff you're doing with UCB One? Because you guys were also slamming out, like, you spent a year here slamming out a video a week.
Yeah.
You guys were on a crazy production schedule.
Yeah.
And this was around that same time.
Yeah. I think we were finishing up UCB One while we were writing it. Me and Rachel were, well, we outlined it over the course of a few months, and then we actually just wrote it in about 2 weeks. But yeah, we were finishing up UCB One's run, and then I shot it in the summer between when there wasn't any digital stuff going on for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so 22 days, some expenses, and then, yeah, you said you did this a lot without any permits. So, like, all the stuff in the streets, all the stuff, like... in the hotel lobby and all that stuff. Are you stealing, is some of that stuff even stuff you're not telling people that you're shooting and you're just nabbing it? Or are you getting permission from a location before you're going in and doing it?
We didn't get any permission. And maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't be saying that publicly, but no, because I have done my homework. I have this book called Clearance and Copyright.
Okay.
Do you know this book?
I don't know it.
It's supposedly, I've heard it's like sort of like the Bible for clearance and copyright issues in Hollywood.
You know what? That needed a Bible. You know what I mean? The equivalency of the Bible. They needed that for clearance and copyright.
And I, so I consulted this book because that's one thing that I was concerned about and I wasn't 100% sure on. I know people steal locations all the time. There's all these anecdotes about people stealing locations, but I wasn't sure exactly what the status of that was legally.
It must come down somewhat to whether or not you can identify the location and whether or not the owner of that location could make a case that showcasing it had some sort of negative impact, right?
Yeah, there you might run into some problems, but basically the
Like if you were like, fuck this Dunkin' Donuts and the piece of shit coffee that had a rat inside of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that might be a problem.
Yeah. But I pretty much what this book says, Clearance and Copyright, is that a location agreement, the purpose of a location agreement is to give you permission to shoot and be there.
Right.
So as long as as long as you're not bothering anybody and nobody asks you to leave, essentially what this book says is you're okay.
Yeah.
You know, I believe the author of the book is a lawyer who, you know, one of his clients was that movie that they shot in Disneyland.
Okay.
You know, without permission.
They shot in Disneyland without permission?
Yeah.
I didn't see that. That's wild.
I think it's called Escape from Foreverland or something. And they basically make Disney out to be like this horrible nightmare. And, you know, I guess they were getting a cease and desist or something, but they fended it off.
Yeah, see, but that's, that's the circumstance.
But that's also, like, there's tons of trademarks there. Trademarks is another issue.
Yeah. And you were trying to be cognizant of that, even on the streets?
Well, but here's the thing with trademarks. Legally, you can show a trademark. Like, if you're shooting a scene with two people having lunch, you can have them drinking a Coke. The problem with trademarks, from a legal perspective, is when you show it in a bad light. So if you use a can of Coke as a murder weapon, then you're getting into, you know, questionable legal territory. But if you're using it in a way that's ordinary and how the product is intended, it's not a legal issue. It can be a sort of business problem. Like, you know, if something is airing on TV, advertisers don't want to have, free advertising for products in the content of the show while they're paying tons of money to
run against it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's also just a matter of, like, it's also a matter of like litigation in most independent projects is losing. Right. And that's the thing
basically,
that those companies
yeah.
have to their advantage against somebody who is, you know, a person as opposed to like a company.
Yeah.
You know, is that like that just the legal action itself is loss for some for a person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If you're getting something thrown at you, you've kind of already lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're we talked about production. OK, yeah. 22 days. It all sort of like goes well. You get into post-production. You said it was like a prolonged sort of process, but you're sort of chipping away at it, and able to take care of a lot of that yourself. And then we also talked about music. You get to the sort of end of the, to get to sort of the final cut and start to think about festivals. Like, what was your thought process? Did you have particular festivals that you felt like this was going to be a great fit for, that you wanted to premiere it at?
Mm-hmm.
What was your thought process going towards festivals and, you know, distribution as you're finishing the film?
Well, to be honest, that's one of the things that this book, I think, could have helped us with, because we didn't really have much of a strategy. You know, it was our first time making a movie, and we were sort of just focused on making the movie. And then, you know, but it's a huge lesson that, I mean, as hard as making a movie is, it's actually not as hard as getting it out there. It's more work and more challenges and also money to try to get it out there. So in retrospect, it would have been nice if we had had a little bit more of a festival strategy. Although we hired a festival consultant, you know, this guy who was a judge at a festival, and he ran a business doing a consulting thing. And he sort of gave us a list of festivals where he thought, it might fit in with their taste. So we went as far as that, but you know, we've sort of been learning as we've been going on the festival circuit. Yeah.
Did you apply to any of the big boys, or was it something that you did?
Yeah.
You did.
We applied to all the big boys. You know what, the big boy that we were really hoping for.
Yeah.
Cause
I like we're saying that. The big boy we were really hoping for. Yes, finish that sentence, Dan.
was Tribeca.
Okay.
You know, because it's a New York City movie, and I've heard that they like to program New York City movies. I have a friend who actually got a short into Tribeca that was an animated short film about him, a real-life story of him meeting his girlfriend on the subway.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of a New York-y little movie that got in.
It's also a great marketplace. Tribeca, I think that's the other thing that it is under known for. But on a business side, I believe that second to Sundance, it's where the most movies get transacted.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also have a friend who used to work at Tribeca, and she warned me that they're also it's apparently a for-profit enterprise, which is not entirely common for festivals. So she was warning us, like, oh, yeah, a lot of times they want, like, movies that have a guaranteed, you know, draw, like celebrities and, you know, track record, some, you know, names, which we didn't have.
So you went for the big boys.
We did.
Then you sort of, like, go for, like, a the next sort of round of things as your premiere. You landed on Vail as the premiere.
Right? Vail Film Festival.
So walk me through the experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks a lot in here about, like, looking at, you know, producers' reps and, like, having, you know, meetings with distributors. And what is the marketplace side of Vail like? And what was the experience like, both as a maker and as somebody trying to sell, a product at a film festival for the first time?
Yeah. Well, Vail was great. It was a great experience. It's not a huge festival in terms of marketplace. Like, a lot of the features there were sort of larger films that had already played around, you know, had played at maybe a Sundance or a South by Southwest or, you know, other bigger festivals. And then they brought them there to show to the local Vail audience.
Yep.
So there wasn't a huge presence of people looking for acquisitions there. But we did network. We networked with people, and we ended up actually getting connected with a distribution company that we got to, you know, we had a conference call with the higher ups there, didn't end up getting distribution through that company, but that was one of the big things that came out of that for us.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, on the ground, it's a lot of meeting filmmakers, sort of chatting, hearing about their experience, both at other festivals and in making their movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's like parties. They had sort of some cool events, like they did a tribute to Julie Delpy and another actress I can't remember right now. So, you know, it's that stuff and seeing screenings and, you know, hanging out in Vail, which is also a ski town. So then they had that
That's fun.
Whole thing going on.
Did you get to go skiing while you were there?
I was planning to, but then once we got there, we were too busy. They got us a TV interview, which was really nice on the
nice,
local
yeah.
TV
Yeah, I saw that station. Press photo on your website.
Yeah.
That's great. And he talks about this sort of festival circuit, too, as being like the thing that people don't realize is that there are going to be sort of like expenses to it, too.
Yeah.
So you were saying before that like getting it out there is equally difficult.
Yeah.
And can be equally expensive.
Yeah.
Right? Like you've probably got some costs associated with that. Like
yes.
all the things of travel and, you know, eating
yeah.
and not working. And not working.
Yeah. Taking off time from work. Yeah. You know, I was pretty naive going into this. I had just always assumed that if you got into a film festival, they would fly you out and give you a hotel. I don't know. Because
yeah.
you're sort of giving them, like, their whole reason for existing. But that is totally not how it works as a whole.
You pay for the whole thing.
Yeah. We had to fly out. Some festivals do, but most don't pay for anything.
One of the ones that I've heard that does, and actually, Sophie, is Toronto.
Uh-huh.
Toronto's one of the ones. It'll fly you.
Wow.
It'll put you up.
And that's a big one. They have a lot of films.
Toronto really treats you.
It treats you good. Okay, so you're sort of like doing that festival, and it's not crazy marketplace.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of like doing more festivals. Like, what did you learn sort of like from the first one, just about expectations or even sort of like the way to do it? You know, from a, I'm sure you do the first one, you're like, yeah, I'm going to spend what I need to spend. And then when you do the third one, you're like, who's got a couch?
Yeah. Actually, well,
actually,
so
I noticed the rest of them are New York, Soho, Kew Gardens.
Yeah,
I think I've learned the lesson, which is stay home.
Yeah, those ones were all easy. Yeah, you know, I didn't have to even miss any work for those. But what my takeaway from Vail and from actually all the festivals so far is sort of it's up to you to do the legwork, you know? There's all these events and stuff, but really the only way you're going to get anything out of it is if you go up, approach people, meet people, you know, find out who people are, tell them about your film, and, you know, you never know what's going to happen from that. Like, that's basically just from
sure
socializing with people is how we got a call with a distribution company.
And when you're sort of like looking at those options, you talked about it sort of at the beginning of our conversation here, but you're looking at some different ways of getting it out there.
Yeah.
So like what opportunities feel like they are there that are either like enticing to you or like what are you sort of like weighing at this point for different means of release, you know?
Yeah. Well.
And I guess how much of it, I'll just follow it up.
Yeah.
How much of it is about recouping cost and how much of it is about like getting exposure to audience
yeah.
as a means of sort of like being able to build onto the next one?
I'm definitely more concerned with the latter,
okay.
you know, connecting with audience,
yeah.
maybe even, you know, connecting with people who might, you know, be interested in working together or, you know, financing something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's where my mind is more at. I mean, I don't think we're going to make our money back, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We never really expected to, honestly. We wanted to make something good and get it out there. That was our goal for this. So I mentioned before this platform called Distribber, which, basically it, you know, it's an aggregator service. You pay some money. It's not a lot. It's not too much. And they'll facilitate getting it onto various streaming platforms, including, you know, ad-based video sites, subscription VOD, and pay, you know, mm-hmm. pay-per-view, I guess, you know, sure. iTunes download, that sort of thing. But, you know, so a lot of those services will screen and sort of decide what they want. Like a Netflix isn't going to take everything that gets pushed at them. They select what they want. Mm-hmm. Same for, I think same for iTunes and a lot of them. But Amazon Prime, I think their model is basically, we'll take you if you're interested. And I think you get something like 15 cents an hour for your content, something like that.
Of what people watch.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it is funny. It's like part of what that calculation changes, I think, is when you do have financing or you do have some sort of like expectation that
yeah.
a creative vision that someone else has taken a chance on, like you have an obligation to pay them back, to yeah. literally pay them back in a way that the liberty that you have in a self-financing is that you can be more respectful to what the goal set that you have as a creative is, which is to sort of like, yeah, get your name and your work
yeah.
out and be able to take a deal even if it's not, you know, going to recoup all costs, mm-hmm. even if it's just going to mitigate costs a little bit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that we don't have to worry about, you know, letting down anybody, including, you know, we didn't even do crowdfunding for this one. We decided to save that for if we ever, you know, really needed to do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I do wonder about that, because and it's something I'm thinking about now, because as I want to do, you know, sort of something a little bit bigger, a little bit of a tier up in the future, it is something you do have to start thinking a little bit more about, you know, who your audience is, who can you see bringing this to?
Yeah.
And that being a part of the model. Although one thing I'm interested in trying for this, because a lot of the advice you get for a smaller film is sort of finding a niche market, you know, which is a big thing. Like, I don't know if you do a documentary about, you know, a friend of mine made a documentary about Mahjong, and she found, you know, a big way of distributing that or getting it out there, just going around to old folks' home, you know, people who are interested in that.
Right. An old folks' home tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't make a sequel, though, because your audience won't be around for it.
It'd have to be the next generation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, like, you know, so one thing, our score was by this jazz group, and they're actually, you know, they're a well-respected jazz group, Invisible Guy, headed by Ben Goldberg. So I've been thinking, you know, maybe there's some angle we could do after, you know, we're done with the festival circuit to sort of bring it around and see if we could show the movie in sort of like a jazz-connected way.
Yeah.
Maybe like do a live score with them if they're interested.
And again, if it's about for you exposure and sort of like the experience,
yeah,
then you can sort of do that. Yeah, you can be really creative in that way, and
yeah.
not feel like it also has to serve that like financial, you know, recompensating, but also like those are fun ways to do that too, potentially.
Yeah,
right, to tour stuff. Touring films sounds really fun. It sounds daunting, but it sounds fun.
Yeah. And it would be in keeping with the sort of DIY aspect that I connect with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about that. I worked on the Improv Everywhere movie, and we talked about, like, is that... And touring was, like, really hot in that moment for, like, indie films.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about, like, is that the right way to do this? Is it like a, you know, a... you know, Charlie does a... MP3 experiments
yeah.
in your city, and they're screening, so it's like a, you know, an Improv Everywhere weekend in your city sort
yeah.
of thing, which sounds really fun. They didn't need to go that route, or didn't choose to go that route for various reasons,
mm-hmm.
but like, yeah, it sounds like it's not just good business, it also is like a fun experience if you sort of plan it out in a way that you're passionate about.
Yeah. And I think you know, a lot of it comes down to like you get what you put in. It's you can't really expect to just be plucked out of the pile, I think. I think the people who are successful are the people who keep on working at it, keep on pushing and just incrementally build their careers.
Yeah.
That's what I have been noticing.
So if we look at this book as a whole,
yeah,
where do you feel like the things, and I know that you read it after the fact.
Yeah.
But what section do you feel like is the section that you're like, yep, like I knew this and this is good advice, and what section do you feel like, oh, I wish I knew this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Stuff I knew and it was good advice. I mean, all the post stuff is pretty good.
Like the music stuff. You knew all the music stuff.
Yes. All the stuff about, you know, making sure you use only cleared music and you know, don't expect to be able to afford known music.
Yeah.
I knew that going in, and I believe that's true. Stuff I wish I'd know. I mean, the stuff towards the end, you know, because that's the stuff that I've found is pretty hard to get good information on, and the stuff at the end is stuff about distribution, yeah, about producers' reps. I didn't know about producers' reps. That's something I would have done if I had known about it, is, you know, you can apparently approach them before festivals, and they can even help you get into festivals sometimes. So that would have been something I would have been interested in doing. You know, the marketing stuff, although that was a little bit geared towards, I think, larger projects than ours, you know, because it's an interesting book because they're talking about a very specific, like, their audience, their core audience for most of this advice is sort of like movies that cost like between, I don't know, $500,000 and $10 million.
Yeah.
And like, if you think about that, like, how many people are there who are actually like directing or producing movies in that range? And I think it's probably, yeah, a little bit less than it was in 2009. Well, yeah, because I mean, there's more movies now because it's easier to make them, but I think a lot of them are more micro budget.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think that, like we talked about this on our like book club episode of this, like, there are certain aspects of this book that feel really dated,
mm-hmm,
even in a short period of time.
Yeah.
In the business, relatively.
It was fascinating to see that. How much things have changed in,
yeah,
what is it, like, just,
yeah,
8 years?
Less than 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's also aspects of it that feel like it's relatively timeless, mm-hmm, in terms of, so long as there's not a wholesale collapse of the business, there are aspects of this that feel like there are, you know, in making movies, here's some good things to be smart about,
yeah,
just so that you're protecting yourself, both as an artist as well as like somebody who is essentially an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody who's trying to make something to reach an audience, get it sold, get it out there.
Yeah.
You know, market it.
Yeah, the one thing, it sort of makes making a movie sound really scary and daunting. I'm sort of glad in a way that I didn't read it before making this first one, because it gives you a lot, it really focuses on the pitfalls, you know?
I can see that, yeah.
And I think it's good to know.
Yeah, and I think that he's coming at it from somebody whose primary work is on the side where they're cleaning up people's messes too, right? Like, mm-hmm, his experience is on the side of the business where people have made mistakes, and he's like, "Don't make these mistakes."
Yeah.
But yeah, when you're sort of thinking about going through it, to hear that as the only advice in the book,
yeah,
is very much like, "Oh, this sounds hard."
Right.
Whereas, like, if you didn't know it, you'd just be like barreling forward, you know.
Right. Like his chapter on screenplay theft, or,
yeah,
you know, that it basically, it, you come out of that thinking like, oh, I can't show my writing to anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's, you know, I think you got to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and sort of.
There's a little paranoia there.
Yeah.
A little bit of paranoia.
Also, a little bit of an axe to grind from,
yeah,
that intro, maybe. Yeah.
Yes, there was a very long preamble to that.
Say it.
Yeah.
I had an experience like this, but none of the following is related to that in any way.
Yeah, there is a little bit of paranoia there,
yeah,
a little bit.
But I really like the book, and I think it gives a lot of information that I've been trying to find, or, you know, on topics that sort of, it takes a lot of work because, like I was saying, it is a specific audience. Even micro budget filmmaking is pretty small. It's a small audience. So just from Googling and, you know, trying to find info on clearance,
yeah,
legal stuff,
yeah,
you know, clearing music, the whole thing about there being two sides to clearing music, there's the rights to the master, and then there's the rights to the publishing. They're two separate entities.
Right.
Stuff like that, it really lays a lot of those tricky issues out and puts them in one place, which is really nice.
And gives you that information that once you have that knowledge, now going forward, you can make things and sort of have those questions in mind. You know,
yeah.
what do I want this to be, and where do I need to sort of like be, you know, thoughtful about the choices of the thing, you know what I mean, of like the kind of music I'm bringing in, mm-hmm. as an example, or the elements or the way that I'm trying to get this financed. You know, like you have the knowledge now to sort of move forward and say, yeah, what are my goals?
Mm-hmm.
How do I want to execute on it? What doesn't apply? What does apply? And then yeah. sort of like, yeah, there's a lot that you can leave on the ground, either yeah. because it's dated or because it doesn't apply to you, because yeah. you're going to self-finance it. But like yeah. there's aspects that even inside of that process are still relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like the Bronx?
Oh, I loved it.
You're doing the American today.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a good one. Have you ever had this one before?
I think I have.
Are you a Bronx drinker?
Yeah. You know, that's my go-to when I go to UCB Theater.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've been enjoying, they have the Summer on Tap down at the East. I've been really enjoying yeah. that one. But this one I think is, I would say this is number three for me in the catalog.
Oh.
I got my ranking system. The Banner is number one.
Okay.
That's the gold standard for me of the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got that Slow Your Roll IPA. And this one's like a solid number three for me. They're
okay.
all good, but I think if I'm going to rank them, that's my order. This is our bronze medalist here. But
well, this is number three.
Yeah. Delicious beer.
I've got to revisit number one and two.
I don't have any. There's no Banner left because we drank it all. Because it was like the most popular one. Because I was like, oh, this is delicious. And so every podcast would be like, another episode of Banner Ale. Yeah. But Dan, the movie is a sibling mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You can catch it sometime soon. Mm-hmm. TBD. Keep looking out there on the internet. And thanks so much for sitting down and chatting, man.
Thank you. This was great.
That will do it for episode number 60 of this podcast. I can't believe we've done 60 episodes. Oh my God. The numbers are racking up. We hope you're enjoying the show out there. If you are, you can go to itunes.com/UCB comedy, subscribe, rate, and review. That's the best way to let us know that this show adds value to your work. You, the makers, and the listeners out there are why we do this show. And just like this episode, we're all ears. If you've got a show idea, if you've got comments and thoughts, tweet at us, UCB Digital. Regram us at Used to Be Digital. Facebook message us, Used to Be Digital Podcast, or just email us if you're old fashioned like that, podcasts, plural, at UCBcomedy.com. Thanks to Dan Erickson for sitting down and having this conversation. The man read a book to do a podcast recording, which is some dedication out there, right, Sophie?
It really is.
It really is. And check out his film at any of the screenings he's got coming up, as well as hopefully on the internet soon. And you can check out the website for the film, asiblingmystery.com. Thank you, Dan, for the conversation. And thanks to our good buddy Reed Martin for his pending feedback. Can't wait to get that feedback. I'll say it again. I can't wait to sort of hear what Reed thought of our Maker Book Club as well. We hope that you'll be back next Tuesday for another new episode of this show when our career track returns week 21 of our epic project tracking the lives and careers of four filmmakers every 7 weeks until I guess until they stop returning our calls. So we
until they stop responding to emails, which is
could be soon.
Yep.
But they are still responding. We're still tracking along with them, and things are getting interesting. So the whole archive of the first 21 weeks are on this feed, and we've got a brand new episode for you next Tuesday where we check in with our four career tracking filmmakers. We hope you'll join us then, and until then, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.